Welcome to Individualizing the Selection of First-Line Therapy for Patients with Hormone Receptor-Positive Metastatic Breast Cancer, the Impact of Biomarkers and Existing Comorbidities. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Adam Brufsky from the University of Pittsburgh. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Brufsky's slide presentation. To begin, Dr. Brufsky presents the case of a 51-year-old woman with ER-positive, HER2-low de novo metastatic breast cancer.
I'm trying to remember whether the RIBO-OS data had come out by this time. Let's assume it had, just for the sake of argument. But I think that, you know, we sat down, and the first thing is she in menopause? That's the first thing. And obviously, we do an FSH&E2, and she was, so she hadn't had a period for a year or two. So, because that's the decision you have to make whether to give an LHRH agonist to oophorectomy. So you have to make the decision first. So we took that out of the way. Now, back then, this is from a couple years ago, we did not have PI3 kinase inhibitors. We didn't have the results from ANOVA yet. So I didn't, at that point, do next-gen sequencing on people. So, you know, we weren't really going to talk about PI3 kinase CDK4/6 fulvestrant triplets. So we didn't talk about that. So really, she's got right bundle branch block. And what I talk about to people, as I say, you know, there are three. And the big thing is difference in side effects. You know, one may have a little bit more white count issues. And, you know, you may have a little bit more infection, say, with ribo and palbo. Ribo in particular has the LFT issues that we have to worry about, but it's a little easier to give because you can dose adjust it. You get three pills in a pack. You can take two or one if you have to. With palbo, you got to actually order a whole new set if you have to go down. So I talk about that with people. With Abema, the big talk is around GI toxicity and the occasional DVTs. That's kind of how I usually talk to people about that. And we sat down and talk about it. And I think that generally, you know, the big things that concern people, obviously, if they have a heart issue, they're very concerned about ribo. If they have some sort of GI issue, you know, maybe irritable bowel syndrome or diarrhea from some other reason, you know, they don't like the Abema. They say no to Abema. And so, you know, with palbo, the problem is just remembering to take it. It's always like you have to remember that 3 weeks on, 1 week off. People don't like that much. And they don't like having to kind of have to order a whole other set of pills. Like, you know, they come in and say, they've ordered my pills, my 125s have come in, but now you're putting me on 100. What am I going to do with it? I just had a copay of $200. You know, what am I going to do with this? You know, usually they bring it in and donate it. So all three have issues with this. In this particular case, we decided to do palbociclib and letrozole for this lady. And she's done very well. I think she's still on it. I mean, I have a lot of people who were on it who were on the initial study. She wasn't one of them, but she still remains on it and is doing pretty well with this, with kind of stable disease a couple years later. So that's kind of how I make this decision up front, at least how I made it. Now, in a new era, you know, now the question is we're going to actually do next gen probably on her biopsy, and we're going to probably make decisions about PI3 kinase inhibitors with palbo and maybe fulvestrant, although she really wouldn't qualify. I don't think de novo patients were allowed in ANOVA 120. So, you know, if, again, she had relapse, maybe we would do that. But in this case, I still probably would give her an AI and a CDK4/6. And again, the choice of CDK4/6 should not be a dogmatic choice. I think it's really important to understand here that, you know, you can choose it based on the clinical profile of the patient and what her particular kind of side effect issues are going to be. And I think that's kind of how I make those decisions.
So I guess what I'm really curious about, particularly given all the real-world data you were presenting there, particularly related to palbo, is what you would say to a patient, again, who's interested in being part of the decision in terms of relative efficacy of the three. Because, you know, even though in terms, you know, you made a very elegant, you know, scientific argument for the fact that it's pretty hard to distinguish it, I don't think anybody could argue with that. I would wonder whether or not you would think it would be appropriate to say to a patient, you know, these are very similar drugs. In a lot of ways, they look, their outcomes seem very similar. But there are some suggestions that maybe ribociclib might be a little bit more effective. Even Abema may be a little bit more effective than palbo. We're not really sure. There are quite a few oncologists who believe that. I'm really not one of them, but just so you know, there are people out there who think that, you know, ribo might be a little bit more effective.
Right. I honestly, I don't. And it's okay to have disagreements. Don't get me wrong. It's okay. I don't. And I won't tell that to patients. I mean, if someone comes in, I mean, I know from my colleagues in Asia, that's a big deal. You know, people come in and say, we want ribo. I've talked to someone, Rebecca Den, a few other people. That's like, the patients come in, we want ribo. We saw the data. But these were, I mean, to get very formal about it, OS was a secondary endpoint in these studies. And, you know, to argue from a secondary endpoint when the trials were not designed that way, you know, is not really, to me, the right way to do it. And the one thing that clearly is different is the adjuvant setting. No one can explain that. I think clearly Abema and Ribo have benefited in the adjuvant setting where Palbo doesn't. The trials clearly show that. In the metastatic setting, though, the hazard ratio for PFS is basically the same. And for us to suggest there's OS differences between the three, especially given the fact that most of the trials show an OS of about 65 months for all three of them, I'm just not... Yeah, I know. And I'll tell you, Neil, for a while, I kind of rode that train for a little bit, the ribo train. But in thinking about this, it just to me, I think they're really all the same. I will present that a little bit to patients about there may be differences, subtle differences between the three. But to me, I just don't think they're clinically significant. Now, I may be wrong. Okay, I clearly could be wrong on this. And, you know, this is welcome disagreement amongst oncologists, and it's perfectly fine. For, you know, someone came to me and they said, I'm only doing ribo and nothing else. I think it's perfectly fine. But I just don't personally believe that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the art of oncology. You know, a lot of basic decisions like mature with time as we get more time to think about it and think about the data. This happens all the time. We see this as, you know, we're just doing a program on PARP and ovarian cancer and how different it is now the way they think about it compared to 2018 when it was first presented. I'm going to ask you about your other case. This is an older patient now, 77 years old, who, again, has a metastatic disease after getting 5 years of an AI, ER positive, HER2 low. Again, what was her symptomatic situation at that point? I see she had some hip pain. Did she get any radiation? Yeah. How did the discussion about CDK go with her?
Yeah, so she comes with hip pain, and it wasn't that bad, but it was enough for someone to work it up. And, you know, again, the decision here is whether to give a CDK at all. And I think that, you know, a lot of people just give it, or will either retreat with an aromatase inhibitor. I think it had been about a year and a half, I think, between, you know, when she had completed her adjuvant therapy. Now we have people on 10 years of adjuvant therapy, so a lot of people recur on their adjuvant AI. But she had recurred after her adjuvant AI, and choice of her would have been AI or fulvestrant alone with or without a CDK. And again, I think that the data, the real-world data, is comforting to me in that, you know, you have these older women that do perfectly fine with the drug. I mean, yeah, there's maybe a little bit of neutropenia, maybe a little bit more diarrhea with Abema. But from a clinical standpoint, what the data shows us is that they're really okay. It's okay to try it. So I really have kind of moved away from AI alone. This was a patient probably in 2016, 2017, I would have given an AI alone to. And now that we have the data, I think AI and palbo are perfectly fine. And, you know, I have a lot of women on it, and I have some women, older women, who don't like it at all. They stop it. And the reason they're stopping it is because of infection. So, you know, what tends to happen, I've had a number of people in my practice who are on these drugs for 2, 3, 4 years, and they just keep getting these skin infections, or they keep getting UTIs. I have one woman who particularly just kept getting UTIs, like every other cycle. And I said, enough is enough. You know, you're seven. This was in this patient, but another one. You're 78, 79 years old. Enough is enough. We'll just leave you on fulvestrant only. We're just doing that. And she's fine. We have a lot of women like that. But in this case, I think it's perfectly reasonable. What I didn't show is really interesting. I gave a talk in Japan about a year ago, and they showed me their real world data. They have data with palbo with a median age of 84 in their trial. So these are really old people who are getting CDK4/6 inhibitors. And I think that's perfect. You know, you got to balance everything. I think that in the case of CDK4/6, you know, you have competing causes of mortality when people get into their 70, 75, 80, 85 years old, you know, and is it worth it? You know, and that's a whole other issue that's separate from the efficacy issue. We know there's going to be a benefit, you know, but in the end of the day, if there's competing causes of mortality, this woman actually is pretty good with no comorbid conditions. But you have a woman who comes in with a lot of comorbidity, you know, cardiac disease in particular, maybe has a 3 to 4 year overall survival from a cardiac disease, then you got to ask yourself, is it really worth it to use it? But in this case, no. In this case, the woman was a very active woman, wanted to do it, and we did it.
Incidentally, correction. I wouldn't call 84 very old. I call 90, 95 very old, but that's just my
fair personal enough. Okay, you know, that's right. I'm not going to be
anyhow, we want to get into the survey that we did. So, you know, we got a pretty distinguished group. We always get, very well-known investigators who participate. We just did this survey. So one thing, and, you know, I was going to also ask, you know, one of our recent programs, I don't know if you saw, there was an editorial in Clinical Cancer Research by Aditya Bardia and Seth Wander. It was actually called Checking the Genomic Code of CDK Resistance. But there's really nice discussion in there about real-world data, and they have a very cool table where they compare real-world to trial to investigator. It was similar to what you went through. And I just wanted to show you, because we did ask in the survey what people thought about it. Most people do think it has value, and maybe not everybody's quite as excited as you are. But it was interesting when we asked them to give examples of where real-world evidence was helpful in ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease, and we didn't specify first-line or not. Actually, a lot of people, probably one of these is yours, but a lot of people did bring up the PALBO real-world data that you were just talking about. But the other thing that people brought up, and actually this came out, this is why it came out in our oral SERDS program, was the real-world data showing amount of time on elacestrant. And the fact that it seemed like 5 months was similar to the trial. And that really opened my mind, you know, because I kind of had always had skepticism about a lot of real-world data in terms of how they got the data. But you know, some variables are a lot more straightforward to get. And time on therapy is, you know, or death, you know, those are pretty, you know, straightforward things to get. And we actually tried to do our own little real-world thing with triple-negative breast cancer to see, in practice, how long were people on, you know, sacituzumab or T-DXd, and again, whether it really matched up to the clinical trial data. So I think, obviously, we're seeing more and more real-world data. I think people really find it reassuring.
Better, believe it or not. Neil, in SASE, there is some real-world data out there. There's an abstract I saw a couple months ago. And basically, it's better. Actually, it was better than they thought for the clinical trial. The PFS was actually, and OS was better than in ASCENT, believe it or not. Now, it's hard to know. Maybe a different patient population, more second line. Who knows? But anyway.
So but let's get back into more the sort of the nitty-gritty of what we asked. We put a whole bunch of those kind of things into the survey just to get a feel for how people see this question of choosing a CDK inhibitor. This is one I was really, you know, sort of a global one I was curious about, because I kept going to investigators going, well, do you think that a PABO is better tolerated in general than RIBO or ABEMA, you know, older patient comorbidities? And I got a little pushback from a couple of pretty well-known investigators who said, oh, no, I think RIBO is just as well tolerated as PABO, for example. But in this survey, it looks like most people do buy into the fact that PALBO is better tolerated. Of course, here's where it gets really interesting, where you go, okay, what do you think is most efficacious? And we've consistently seen, ever since the RIBO survival data came out, a definite shift. You see it here. More than half of the people think that RIBO is more efficacious. And again, I'm sure even they realize that that's not, you know, that's just their viewpoint, just like you have your viewpoint. And in terms of tolerability issues, really, they reflected the same things that you were just talking about, also in terms of convenience. But I wanted to go through a bunch of scenarios. First, any comments about what you've seen so far?
No, they're consistent with my, I mean, I know most of the colleagues. We all know each other, as you know. And I think that, you know, most of us, it reflects pretty much opinion right now, the way it is. And even among the community, I think it's the same thing. I think you can see about half-half, you know, in terms of efficacy. But I think most people believe PALBO is the most well-tolerated of the three. I would say that that data probably does reflect the community in the United States. I would be surprised if it didn't.
So we broke this out into, we initially were just curious in general, but when we first started to think about this project, about how people, you know, picked therapy in the typical situation, HER2 negative, and we weren't even thinking about pick three when this started. And then all of a sudden, you know, as you pointed out, you have INAVO coming on. So now pick threes are an issue first line. And there, INAVO was combined with PALBO, So we were curious, are people doing it? Are they using Palbo? And then, of course, just in San Antonio, to me, one of the greatest papers we've seen in the last few years at San Antonio was Bettina looking at Palbo in HER2-positive disease. So we were curious to see, because we were hearing both of those things, and we've even done surveys already showing people are picking that up. But we'll get to that later. Let's start out first with a PIK3 wild type and HER2 negative. This scenario was a patient who got 5 years of therapy and now 2 years later has relapsed. We were curious whether people go back to an AI, for example, fulvestrant, and you can see that there's kind of a split there in terms of that. But again, in a younger patient without any specified comorbidities, most common CDK that they cite is ribo.
And that's fine. People are welcome to do it. Yeah, I mean, they're basing it on the OS difference, you know, and I get that. And I see why they're doing it. But to be honest, I mean, everybody's welcome to their opinion. You know, it's not my particular opinion, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. I think, again, they're all three roughly, in my opinion, the same. And there's no, if you choose it because you think it's better, so be it. It's perfectly fine.
I mean, I think we go through this almost every program we do now in oncology, multiple agents within the same class. We just did a program yesterday on bispecific lymphoma. There are four of them, no direct comparison of any of them. So you have to do indirect comparisons. And whenever you do indirect comparisons, there's always uncertainty. And what we see is there's a lot of more heterogeneity when you ask people what they actually do. You know, what we do is we call this going beyond the guidelines. Because the guidelines are going to go, well, you got three choices. They're all pretty similar. Maybe one's a little bit better. But what we do is we go, well, okay, that's fine. But what do you actually do? And sometimes we see everybody does the same thing, but a lot of times we don't. And here's some good examples. So you brought up the issue of prior heart disease. And I'm curious, too, what type of heart problems get you more concerned about using ribo? In this case, we said heart failure, patient on an ACE inhibitor, beta blocker, and people are all over the place about either which AI, which CDK, and whether AI or fulvestrant. History of myocardial infarction 3 years ago, again, all over the place. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so the first thing I think, I'll start with the AI versus fulvestrant. I think that's reflective of people's thoughts about whether you should be 1 year, 2 year, 3 years out, you know, to repeat it. So that's okay. That's where that's coming from. I think the ribo choice here in the setting of congestive heart failure has come really from the right choice data, which is really kind of where this patient fits, symptomatic visceral mets, you know, showing that it is more beneficial than chemo. I suspect that's where that's coming from. But on the other hand, I think the reason there's hesitancy is because of the congestive heart failure. What I'm more worried about is not so much CHF, which I am, but rather more rhythm disturbance. You know, people with bundle branch block or, you know, some sort of, you know, some sort of block or maybe on a beta blocker already for reasons, you know, of heart failure. You know, people who really have kind of things where the rhythm can get messed up, I worry about this. You know, again, the problem is that it's not so, you know, you do have the QT prolongation and generally it's not a, it to all of us, I think is more of a lab abnormality, but people have sudden death with metastatic breast cancer for a variety of reasons. And you don't, most of the time, you don't know why. You're not going to do an autopsy. And even if they do an autopsy, you know, you're probably going to see widespread metastatic disease, and you're not going to know whether they really had a rhythm disturbance or not. And I just don't want to be in that position, I think, for me personally. And so that's kind of why I kind of shy away from ribo, I think, with more of the congestive heart failure rhythm disturbances.
Incidentally, I'll tell you, we also asked asymptomatic bone-only mets, and we still saw the same split. We still saw people saying ribo in these situations. Yeah. So again, you know, that you know, that's why, I mean, it seems simple, but you really get a lot of granularity when you look at this and you understand that maybe if I send this patient to an investigator for a second opinion or they decide to go, not sure what they're going to say, depends on who it is. So correct. Again, focusing more on particular comorbidities. And so here's a situation of a prior inflammatory bowel disease and not too much abema, like only a couple of people, but still a couple of people saying they'd still go with abema. But again, more ribo than palbo. How do you think it through in a patient with inflammatory bowel disease with constipation?
Right. So again, it's the same thing. You know, the first thing is that, you know, it's the 2 years, you know, so that's kind of reflective of the AI versus fulvestrant. I think that there is less abema here, mainly because of the GI toxicity. I think that there's probably more ribo, again, reflective of not so much the OS benefit, but rather the right choice data because the patient has symptomatic liver mets. I think that's where we have the data, and I think that's why people are saying that. I think that's where that's coming from. But that's kind of the reason, you know, you see that. I think that, again, ribo compared to abema, as we showed, has less diarrhea in that meta-analysis. So I think it's totally reasonable to do ribo in this setting. You know, I personally, again, think they're all the same. For me, it doesn't matter, but I have no problem with that.
So systemic lupus with asymptomatic neutropenia, and the most common answer now is abema. Any thoughts?
Yeah. It's interesting because there's even more subtlety to this than this. But the other two have neutropenia. And so, you know, obviously you want something that has the least neutropenia. And it's not a problem to give abema. I think, you know, the issue, though, with abema is that we've noticed that when we give it with checkpoint inhibitors, you get pneumonitis. So abema has some sort of weird immune things going on with it. And even though we don't know right now, we're totally blind, this is all total speculation, you know, I'm a little concerned about abema in people with, you know, underlying, you know, autoimmune disease. I got to tell you. Now, I'm trying to think in my mind if I've ever given abema to those patients. I usually give them palbo. But I think it's an interesting question because I am concerned about the pneumonitis that you get from the combo when you give a checkpoint inhibitor. So something's going on there that we don't quite understand. But nonetheless, I can totally understand why abema is being used here.
So we also presented a scenario where the patient had multiple comorbidities, difficulty managing polypharmacy. And here now we see a bunch of people saying maybe they wouldn't use a CDK inhibitor, but those who do either palbo or ribo, I'm sure this may vary a lot based on, you know, the patient's performance status, et cetera. But I guess it gets into the issue of a patient with non-urgent disease, although this patient scenario did say liver mets, that you could say, hey, we'll hold off on the CDK and, you know, treat later on.
Yeah,
is
I think
what you do?
Sometimes, yeah. And I think in this case, you know, you can give her a fulvestrant and see what happens for a bit. But this is someone who may get an ADC. She may get an ADC. I mean, she may get a TDXD. I think because that has less neutropenia, number one. But you'll get a sense of how rapidly her visceral mets progress or not. And again, you got to be careful because it can suddenly get so bad that suddenly she has LFT abnormalities, her bilirubin's now 8, and then you can't give her anything. So you got to be kind of careful. This is really the art of medicine right here, is what you decide to do, especially with polypharmacy.
So, of course, everybody says age is just a number, which to a great extent is true. I was flashing before when you were talking about comorbidities on the Adjuvant Online program that Peter Ravdin developed many years ago. And one of the things I loved about that was it actually literally numerically factored in competing causes of death in a 90-year-old or an 85-year-old, which obviously is very important. So we asked about, again, symptomatic liver mets, but now age 80, PS2, and frail. And again, you see not everybody using CDK, but those who do now, it's just palbo. Age 90, same thing, even less CDK when they do it, palbo. How do you, as patients get older, you know, I'm sure you see 90 or 92 or 3-year-old women who are in good condition. How do you present this to them?
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, I think that, you know, there's so many competing causes of mortality now, especially in a frail person, that, again, you have to ask yourself the absolute benefit you're getting out of palbo. I mean, sure, you're getting a PFS benefit, and maybe that helps if someone's symptomatic, especially this woman has symptomatic visceral mets. Maybe you do want a higher response rate. But the response rate to AIs or fulvestrant alone here is still about 45%. You're maybe getting 10, 15% extra. That's what you're looking for now. You're looking for resolution of her symptoms, which are going to be related to your response rate. So, you know, you're trying to kind of decide in your mind, do I want another 10 or 15% response rate versus the extra kind of issues with polypharmacy, frailty, et cetera, and competing causes of mortality. And this is really a multifactorial decision. This is more of, again, an art of medicine. You look at the patient, you talk to her, and figure that out.
So I think these trends seem that we've already described in terms of how people deal with people who are older or people with comorbidities seem to extend through different scenarios, including people relapsing on endocrine therapy, including de novo. But I was just kind of curious in general. It's funny because we were just getting into this with prostate cancer. Globally, the difference between de novo metastatic ER-positive HER2-negative disease and recurrent in terms of aggressiveness, how you think through it. Do you think, is your strategy different in a patient presenting with metastatic disease?
It really depends on the length, on the timing. I mean, there's a lot of issues that are now new that are coming up. I mean, I think that, you know, if someone progresses pretty rapidly, you know, within a couple of years of starting her endocrine therapy, that's definitely someone who progressed after 5 or 6 or 8 years. And someone who's progressed after 8 years who's on an AI or TAM or whatever, who's not. So those are things that kind of get factored into this decision. As opposed to de novo disease. De novo disease tends to be, at least in my opinion, a little bit easier to treat and has a little bit better prognosis than relapse disease, at least in the patients I've seen. But I don't really tailor my therapy any differently. I think the only reason I would tailor it differently would have to be due to those rapid progressors. I think if someone has progressed, you know, off all therapy and it's 5 years later, you know, they're treated like they're de novo.
So I want to get into a couple of other scenarios. So this is people on CDK. So this is a scenario of a younger patient, 65 years old, who's actually receiving ribo and an AI for de novo ER-positive disease and develops QTc prolongation 6 months into initiating therapy. So again, they're split between Abema and Palbo. I'm going to guess you'd be more likely to go to Palbo.
Yeah, again, you can do either one, and that's your choice. I mean, I think it's what you're more comfortable with as a physician making that decision. You know, if you like Palbo better, to use it. But I think everybody will go away from ribo with QT. Although you saw some people will just reduce the dose and continue because probably their feeling is ribo clearly has more OS data and QT is kind of like a lab abnormality. So maybe if I reduce it, I think that's kind of explains those ribo people. But most of us would use Palbo or Abema.
So we also said, okay, the patient's on Abema and they get diarrhea. We're saying grade 1. Most people, as you were just alluding to, would decrease the dose. Some would continue at the same dose, not too many people switching. When we say grade 2, now we see a couple people switching, but still holding on to the strategy. What does it take you? Well, you probably prefer Palbo to start with, but how much diarrhea does it take for you to want to get off of Abema?
I mean, I think that, you know, I'll give them a couple times of grade 2. You know, I'll do a dose reduction of grade 2. And, you know, if they'll do a grade 1 and then I'll do another dose reduction. Now, usually you start a lot of people at 150. But to be honest with you, the data shows us, both from Monarch E in the adjuvant setting as well as the metastatic data, that you can actually reduce the dose. So, you know, you can go at 100. In fact, a lot of people start at 100 now instead of 150, even though that's not the label. And you can go to 50. And so I would usually dose reduce and go to 50 if I see grade 2. And if they still have diarrhea, then I just stop and put them on Palbo. That's usually how I do it. And I do about a quarter of my patients start Abema for some whatever reason. So, you know, it's not like they all get Palbo, but that's kind of how it's reflected in that. I usually follow the same kind of way that they're doing it there. I think grade 2, persistent grade 2, they have to come off it, despite a reduction of 50 BID.
So this is a question we put in there. You were referring to the trial looking at Palbo and then another trial looking at ribo versus chemotherapy in patients with visceral disease, you know, visceral crisis. And of course, the CDK inhibitor in those trials looked better than chemo. But what I was curious about it, I'm not sure, I don't think those trials actually looked at it as a strategy that I don't think is used that often. But again, extreme situation, a patient in the ICU, maybe lymphangitic disease, I don't know what it would take. But the question of short-term chemo followed by endocrine maintenance, and it looks like that is a strategy that most of the investigators have done. I don't know if you've ever done it. And any thoughts about that? And am I right in saying that really wasn't looked at in those two trials?
It was not. And I think that it's an interesting question. It's what we used to do. I used to do it all the time before we had the right choice.
Right.
So a lot of us would give chemo to kind of consult, you know, they would give chemo to get through that initial, say, ascites phase or, you know, bulky liver disease or multiple areas of pain issue, you know, to come in woman really kind of acute, do chemo to get them through them, you know, weekly paclitaxel or something else. Now it's maybe an ADC in the future, but get them through that. And then once they get to some area of stability, transition them to a CDK4 and endocrine therapy. I think some of us do that. Now that the Right Choice data has come out, we've now had a year or two to kind of reflect on it. I think a lot, it's really will take a lot for someone to get chemo up front for my practice in this case.
So I want to move on now and talk about, again, a couple of issues that I didn't really think about when we first started to plan this because the data hadn't come out. And one is what you referred to now, the triplet, the INAVO study, looking at inavolisib with palbo and fulvestrant in patients who are endocrine resistant. So in the trial, they had to either be on endocrine therapy or been within a year of endocrine therapy. So theoretically, like a scenario we talked about before, theoretically, a patient 2 years after finishing endocrine therapy would have been eligible for the trial. The FDA indication actually is a pretty general, which I thought is kind of interesting in terms of endocrine resistance. But we actually had a poster looking at this. We'd already seen that as soon as people saw that data and got approved, they started using it. So we presented a bunch of scenarios. Not every single person is doing it. You know, maybe more likely if you have symptomatic liver mets, but even with asymptomatic bone mets, the triplet is clearly the favorite approach. And, you know, also in patients at the previous scenario, the patient was on 5 years of therapy and then 1 year later developed mets. So that would have fit into the trial. We also said, okay, they're on 2 years of an adjuvant AI when they relapse. They clearly would have fit in the trial. And now almost everybody says the triplet. But this is the thing, I kind of didn't even appreciate it the first time I saw the data. You know, you think about endocrine resistance, but if they're de novo, they can't be endocrine resistant. So obviously Correct. They weren't in the trial, as you alluded to before, but we were kind of curious, would they still do it? And actually, there are several, particularly if we say, you know, symptomatic liver mets, you have a fair number of people saying that the triplet, when we say, okay, they're asymptomatic bone mets, now almost nobody says it. But kind of an interesting, I interviewed Kamal Javari. I forgot to ask her about this. She was talking about, okay, you know, maybe go beyond 1 year into two, three, or whatever. But I didn't even think about de novo. So what do you do with de novo?
Great question. I mean, I think, remember the de novo patients in Right Choice, I think, had a PFS benefit, I think, of 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. And there was probably a third of those patients were PI3 kinase mutated. And what I'd love to know, and this is actually probably needs to be done, is go back to Right Choice and see how many people were PI3 kinase mutated in that trial and how they did. And if they did substantially worse, then I think that makes the case for inavolisib. And that's kind of a sub-analysis, obviously. It's a post-hoc sub-analysis of Right Choice, but I'd love to know that analysis, how the PI3 kinase patients did. I just don't remember anybody doing that. And if you show that they definitely did worse on ribonucleic AI with the visceral mets, then I think there was a case to be made for the triplet, even though we don't have data. Yes.
Well, one thing that I don't see on these answers is INAVO plus either ribo or abema. So, you know, people Correct. Usually stick with it. I mean, I'm sure they picked a palbo because they thought it's better tolerated. They're adding in a new drug. But at least the investigators in general are kind of, you know, if they're going to do INAVO or using palbo. So it's kind of interesting that now one of the ways palbo is sort of coming back is through the pick three route, because we're seeing like everybody wanting to do this triplet. And then, of course, the other thing that just happened was HER2 positive. I just love, I've always been fascinated about triple positive disease. You know, I always loved like the neratinib data and why they saw greater benefit in the ER positive and all. But anyhow, so we, you know, have been hearing that people are kind of ready to use palbo already just by seeing the data presented at San Antonio. So we presented a, you know, 6-year-old patient who gets TCHB and responds, and now they're about to go on maintenance, probably with trastuzumab, pertuzumab. And the question is, would you add hormone therapy? But most importantly, would you add palbo or would you add a CDK? And now almost everybody's saying CDK for HER2 positive age 65. But again, we push up to make it age 80 PS2, and people aren't as aggressive. Anyhow, any thoughts in general about HER2 positive disease and CDK in general, and even endocrine therapy in general, which I feel like hasn't been talked enough about over the years?
Well, you know, the thing is that, again, there are multiple pathways that are being affected here. And breast cancer is heterogeneous. You know, the one thing, I grew up in the prostate cancer world, actually, before I became a breast cancer doc. And the one thing about prostate cancer is he's always continued the hormonal therapy, right? Even if you became castrate resistant, right? You always either have, if you had an orchiectomy, you continue your LHRH. And because I think it's only 30 or 40% of the disease that actually is the problem. You know, you're still treating the other 60% of the disease, the heterogeneous disease, with your endocrine therapy. And there's no reason to think breast cancer isn't the same way. So I really think that it's important to hit as many of these pathways as you can within reason. I think PALB1A naturally was a great idea. I mean, I think, you know, it builds off some of the data from Pertain, which was an AI being added to HP in tropopositive disease, and it was the natural extension. And you can't argue. I think the PFS was like 45 months or something like that, 44 months. You can't argue with that. It's pretty good. Now, the real question is going to be when DB09 comes out, and DB09, as you know, is going to be T-DXd compared to THP. And if it's continued DXd until progression. So we're, you know, someone comes in with triple positive disease, what do you do? You know, do you, you're going to maybe add an AI? I guess he's adding an AI to DXd, but can you add PALBO to DXd? There's no data whatsoever. And I think it's going to be a really interesting dilemma that we're going to face, especially if DB09 really comes out with a dramatic PFS benefit in the first line. You know, what are we going to do? Stop the DXd after a year or something, or maximal response, and then give them PALBO and AI and HP? I don't know what people are going to do. But what they're going to do is probably not going to be based on clinical trial data, because we don't have any yet. But I think that it's nice, you know, again, Neil, you've been in this business as long as I, probably longer than me. You know, it's, we went in breast cancer from nothing, you know, maybe CMF and anthracyclines and ketoconazole and tamoxifen to this. We have a plethora of riches 30 years later. It's great, but we have to figure out how to use them properly and in what sequence. But it's great to have it.
So I like to joke that Las Vegas is no longer taking and wagering on DB09 because everybody is completely expecting T-DXd to blow it away. But again, I mean, how long can you give T-DXd? I mean, I think people are going to stop it.
Fatigue is the big one. When I have people on long-term, that seems to be what happens, is the fatigue. You know, obviously you've got the ILD that can happen at any time. And the nausea, usually with olanzapine, I think we can control the nausea, maybe dose reduction. But I think the real issue is fatigue. You get people who just are tired of it after a year or two. They just are not. They just, listen, Dr. Barsky, you got to stop.
This is our way of figuring out whether something's practice changing. I mean, when you think about it, this is right after the day was presented, within a couple of months, and already more than half of the investigators have already given PALBO to HER2-positive patient, and all the rest of them say they're just waiting for the right patient. And speaking of that, I mean, I would assume that people are going to be more interested in doing this and the higher the risk the patient.
Yeah. I think in the metastatic disease, yes. In the adjuvant, you know, people starting to think about this in the adjuvant setting. I wouldn't do it. I don't think it's going to be approved in the adjuvant setting. The issue here is, and this is a practical issue, is that insurers, you know, they've just been sensitized. If they see HER2, they refuse to pay for the CDK. You know, because what I would be doing, if someone's exhausted all their HER2-based therapy, you know, and now they're like, you know, fifth, sixth line, I would try to do a CDK in them, you know, because these are people, this is before the Patina data came out. And I would get refused. They would say no. They say you've got to stop the HER2 in this patient. I can't let you give both. So it's interesting what's going to happen in the community and how the payers are going to react to this. And it may be local based on your particular payer and your payer mix, what they're going to allow.
So I want to conclude with another kind of version of how we look at real-world data. And what we did was we went to three general medical oncologists that we work with all the time. They review our data. They present cases, you know, pretty smart general medical oncologist. And we said, give us some patients where you actually use Palbo as your first CDK. And then, so we're going to get a second opinion here. I mean, on these are real cases from practice. All right, 62-year-old woman, history of IBD with diarrhea, uncontrolled AFib, receiving amiodarone, and presents with ER-positive metastatic disease. HER2 is low with lung mets. How would you think through endocrine therapy? In this case, the most common answer was Palbo and an AI.
Yeah, that's how I would think through it. I mean, I think that here's somebody who has IBD, so Abema is kind of, I'm not really too happy about Abema because of GI tox. AFib, I'm not too happy about Ribo because of the potential for QT prolongation. And so Palbo and AI would be my choice. I would agree with the majority of the people in this.
Here's another real case. And it's interesting when you get into the real world how many times you see multiple comorbidities, not just one, even in younger patients like this 66-year-old woman who had 5 years of adjuvant letrozole. 2 years after finishing the letrozole, she's found to have asymptomatic pulmonary nodules. On biopsy is a recurrence. She is receiving two medications to manage her mental illness, and one of them is known to cause QT interval prolongation. So it sounds like asymptomatic metastatic disease to the lung in a 66-year-old, but on a psychiatric medication. Most people say Abema here. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with Abema. I think Abema, the reason people are choosing Abema because the idea that somehow it's better for visceral disease than Palbo. I don't think I would choose Ribo. I think the reason they're choosing Abema is because of that data that supposedly it's better. I don't think it's any better, but the bottom line is that I think either Palbo or Abema is fine. Ribo, probably no.
66-year-old woman with history of extensive coronary disease, receiving multiple medications, gets adjuvant chemo, radiation therapy, 5 years of anastrozole, and then 3 years later, after finishing hormonal therapy, again, multiple bone men mets as well as lung mets that are biopsy positive. How would you think it through? And is this a patient, incidentally, for the patient with PIK3 positive, would you give the triplet knowing that it was 3 years after finishing hormonal therapy?
I probably would hold off on the triplet and give it sequential because, again, I think that I really want the people who have rapid progression, the more rapid progressors. You know, I put people into buckets, you know, like really rapid, like 6 months, medium, you know, which is like probably a year to 3 years, and then, you know, way out there, like 3 to 7 years or something. So, you know, I put her probably into that intermediate to long-term bucket. I like Palbo and AI, again, because she does have left bundle branch block. I'm kind of a little concerned about Ribo here. And so I think my own bias, I think, would be for just the Palbo and AI.
So here's an interesting one. 44-year-old premenopausal woman. ER positive, HER2 negative, IDC, gets neoadjuvant chemo, then mastectomy, bilateral salpingeal oophorectomy, followed by adjuvant letrozole with Abema for 2 years. So 1 year after completing the Abema, she's found to have liver mets, biopsy proven. And this is a real case in practice, both ESR1 and PIK3 positive. And here, yeah. Actually, the most common choice was the triplet.
Yeah, it's a great question. We don't have data for this yet. And I think that I could be going with capivestrin or an inavolisib, palbo-fulvestrin. I'm okay with that. I don't expect a huge benefit from Palbo only a year after receiving adjuvant Abema, but I understand why the triplet would be given. I have no problem with it. And capivestrin. I think... The theme here is a PI3 kinase inhibitor. You really treat this person almost as a second-line patient. And I think that's the theme here. And I don't have a problem with either one. I think they're both reasonable.
So you said that you had a prior interest in prostate cancer. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that there's a press release out there. There's a positive phase 3 trial in de novo metastatic prostate cancer with CAPI.
Really?
We don't have the data. Yes. And we're doing a symposium at the AUA meeting for urologists on AKT inhibition. Okay. So wow. We don't know, the magnitude of the benefit. But, you know, I mean, the hazard rates in breast cancer are pick three and, you know, are pretty good. They're less than 0.5. And who knows what they're going to see here. But the thing that I think is incredible is the day this data is presented, if it is really positive and practice changing, then the urologists are going to have to learn how to use CAPI if they want to treat these patients. And that's
like have to learn how to manage diabetes.
I mean, think. Well, guess what? It was with abiraterone and prednisone.
Wow, on top of it. So, yeah, I mean, you got prednisone with a drug that induces diabetes. You know, it's kind of like, that's going to be tough. It's a tough management situation. And they're in the OR a lot. And the thing is, who's going to manage their patients? You're in the OR and you get a call, the glucose is 100 and is 300. What are you going to do?
I'm dying to see the data.
Bringing this back to breast, I'll tell you, a triple negative patient that has AR, you know, there's this whole luminal AR triple negative that has a PI3 kinase mutation, I suspect that this will kind of encourage trials in that space if we can do it. If we haven't done them already, I think someone's trying to do it. But I think I'm really curious to see that now, especially if this AR positive prostate cancer, you know, CAPI is really working. I think it's great.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Okay, here's another real world case. This is a real case from practice. And I guess you could say this is a little challenging. So 63-year-old woman who has recurrent disease to the lung, bone, and liver after 6 years of receiving adjuvant letrozole. And again, ESR1 and PIK3. You know, we get into this in the second line setting too. What do you do with ESR1, PIK3? Some people use elacestrant or SERD. Others use CAPI. Again, we didn't make this up. This is for real. And the patient's hemoglobin A1C was 8.5%. So 8 different choices here. But how do you think this one through?
I think a CDK and fulvestrant is perfectly fine. I think that, you know, this is somebody, let me see, what does she have? She has liver mets. So, you know, there's a bulk of disease here that with elacestrant, I'm just not, even though it's 6 years later, I'd think elacestrant, but I think I'm more happy with a CDK plus fulvestrant right now. I mean, if imlunestrant and abema were available, you know, if eventually EMBER-3 gets FDA approval, I think I would think about that. But yeah, I think a CDK and fulvestrant is the right way to go.
So here's another patina real-world answer from the faculty, but this is a real case. A 54-year-old woman, metastatic disease to the lung and liver, who presents, she has de novo metastatic disease, her HER2 positive, gets chemo and trastuzumab, good partial response. The question is, what's maintenance? Almost everybody says trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and palbo. A couple of people say just trastuzumab without pertuzumab. Maybe people got discouraged about using pertuzumab. Again, any thoughts to you? Sometimes not use pertuzumab.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, I think that I'm the same way. I would give the TP plus palbo-endocrine therapy. I think it's not hard to give, especially if you're going to give it like Phesgo. You know, you're going to give the sub-Q dose. I think it's an easy regimen to kind of give people. It's expensive, but it's an easy regimen to give people. I'm there.
So anything you want to add, any thoughts that popped into your head as we were talking about this, and any things you see, docs, and I'm sure you see tons of second opinions of people managed by other doctors, anything you see people doing that you wouldn't do or you think your investigator colleagues wouldn't do, any sort of misperceptions, again, about first-line therapy of ER-positive metastatic disease?
No, I mean, I think it's reasonable. I think, you know, everybody's going to have a difference of opinion about the real true benefit of ribo versus the other two based on that OS data. So I don't have a problem when people come in on ribo. The problem I have with ribo is just the LFT abnormalities. It's not really the QT. And that can be a problem. I mean, you got to stop their drug for 6 or 8 weeks, and that bothers me. But short of that, I don't have a problem with people coming in like that. It's reasonable. I think the real questions that are going to come in the future are going to be people who had adjuvant CDK. What are you going to do? And especially if they relapse within a year or two, how do you manage them? And how do you integrate? When do you decide to pull the trigger on an upfront ADC as opposed to giving them endocrine therapy and a CDK? And then those are the questions that I think second opinion people are going to get in the not too distant future. So they're not getting them now. That's probably what's happening.
So final weird thought that I had last night, I was sort of thinking about this. What is the most important advance from the point of view of patient care in second line therapy or second line and beyond of ER-positive metastatic disease. And for all the great discussions and programs we've done on oral SERDs and AKD inhibitions, I would answer the question with T-DXd.
Yeah, but again, T-DXd only has 10-month median PFS. So I think that we have a plethora of things to do. And what we really need, we need guidance. This is an area crying out for biomarkers. You know, some sort of genomic guidance of some sort or genetic guidance to help us figure out which to give when. And because they're not going to be clinical trials. This is our problem. You know, when we treat people post-ADC, be it DXd or SG or now Dato, we have no idea what to do with them. There's no data whatsoever. You know, you progress on T-DXd for second-line therapy for ER-positive breast cancer, metastatic disease. Where's the data? There's no data whatsoever on what to do next. And that's going to be a problem. We're going to be just shooting blind, really, based on our own clinical intuition, which is fine. I don't think trials are going to answer this. I think this is back to coming back to real-world data. I think analysis of large databases, once we have a ton of people who've been post-ADC, I think that we'll be able to answer those questions. That's where real-world data is going to help us out a lot going forward.
I think my mindset is influenced a lot by the SGO, gynecologic oncology meeting, and we did a program just on HER2-positive gynecologic cancers, and it was really amazing because this is the first time I really saw T-DXd having an impact. We were getting cases from community-based gynecologic oncologists, and I was seeing the same look on their face when they talked about a patient responding, and what I was thinking about was not so much about PFS, but tumor response. You know, sick people becoming much better.
With and ascites, really, to come in, this is crazy.
Exactly. But I it kind of reminded me when T-DXd first came out in breast cancer, and I would hear the docs presenting these cases with this big smile on their face when they saw a patient responding. And then it took a while to see this come into gynecologic cancers, but I think it's there now. They're using it and it's working.
Yeah, and I really think we're moving towards just an agnostic indication, I suspect. You know, that if you're in HER2-low, or which is just about everybody, or HER2-amplified in particular, I think there may be an agnostic indication coming.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Brovsky, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Individualizing the Selection of First-Line Therapy for Patients with Hormone Receptor-Positive Metastatic Breast Cancer, Impact of Biomarkers and Existing Comorbidities.